I'd like to take a second to dedicate this episode to my grandfather who has just passed. And while this episode is not at all connected to him, I am processing that loss and grief through work and movement and connection and rooting down into this practice. And he wasn't really familiar with self-directed education or educational models. He didn't even go to school past the fifth grade, but he fully supported my being a present mother and my choosing what I felt was best for them. And he always was supportive of it and always praised the ability to do so. So this is for him. Well, hello, folks. Welcome back to the Unschool Files. I'm your host, Megan, and you're listening to episode 30 of the podcast. This one's kind of a long one, so I'm going to keep the intro brief. I'm going to drop you right into a candid conversation with an Austin-based unschooling mama named Demetria. She shares a lot of insight on living life with neurodiverse children, the ins and outs, and day-to-day, while being neurodiverse herself. We discuss some downsides to rushing into what all of the unschooling books say for neurodiverse kids. We talk about primary and supporting activities and screens and building support systems and finding ways to say yes for neurodiverse children. So you are going to want to listen to the entire thing. I know it may be difficult to get it all at one time, maybe break it up in chunks, but I am so, so grateful that she spent this time with me, and I hope that you enjoy this conversation. Join me in welcoming Demetria to the podcast. Hi, Demetria. Thank you so much for joining me. I have been looking forward to this conversation for so long, and I'm glad that we're here finally connecting.
Really, really excited to have this conversation. There's just so much to, I'm sure even, one episode won't cover it, but we definitely have a huge community of us within this community who need to have more of these discussions around like what it's really like day to day. So I'm really excited to talk about that.
Absolutely. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your relationship to unschooling?
Okay. So my name is Demetria. I'm married and we have three kids. Our oldest is 13 and he'll be 14 in December. And he, thinks he's an adult because he's taller than me now. And he's so funny. He is autistic. He was diagnosed when he was 5 and he had gone to public school up until he was in the fifth grade. And then our middle son is 9 and he went to school up until first grade. And then our youngest, our daughter is 8 and she went to kindergarten. So like preschool, pre-K and then kindergarten. And they're just, our whole family is neurodivergent. Some of us are officially diagnosed with different things. Some of us are not. I think we all live in this space where some things aren't as cleanly defined as they define the community, but we're kind of all the same, so we just operate in that way. For unschooling, when we were living in, we live in Austin now, and when we lived in Atlanta, we moved to Austin in the summer of 2019. My husband got a job offer within his same company, but it required a relocation to here to Austin. Mm-hmm. And so he actually requested a sort of 14-month window to move so that we could let the kids sort of finish out that last year of public school. My mm-hmm. son was going to fifth grade, and it just kind of felt like it would have been really even more difficult to uproot him at that time. So we kind of gave him that year, but that gave me a year to really do my own deschooling or at least get the process started for myself and kind of just work through, how I would see our life as unschoolers. I had a good friend of mine at the time was a public school, middle school teacher, and our sons were both in the same autism class. And so we were talking about, what is it going to look like them for middle school? Because middle school is just a really Mm-hmm. It's just that, you know, it's a hard time. Like, they're going through so many changes. And then, you know, they're all put together in, like, you know, all of our elementary schools funneled into that one middle school. So they're talking about, you know, hundreds of kids, and just less support, right? And then there's just so much, you know, with the suicide rates for middle schoolers and the stress levels. And we were like, what are we going to do about this? Like, we got to figure it out. And she was like, I think I'm going to consider homeschooling. She's like, you should probably do that. And I was like, I just got my last kindergarten. What? You want to bring them back here? Why? You know? And then I just kept feeling like, this is sitting on me. So I started looking into it. And then kind of at the same time, I came across Dr. Shefali, and I saw an interview that she had done, obviously, around conscious parenting. And then I started reading her books. So they kind of, as I was digging into homeschooling styles, I learned about unschooling. Like, first I was like, okay, this is too rigid for me. I'm not going to be able to pull this off. You know, I always knew I didn't really want to do the school at home thing. That just was not going to work. So I was like, okay, well, what about eclectic homeschooling? What about relaxed homeschooling? I'm like, that's getting closer, but... So then when I saw unschooling and then, you know, they kind of intersected with conscious parenting, I was like, this is it. This is idea. And then when we realized we're moving here and how Austin is really, you know, supportive of sort of that lifestyle and lots of alternative education options, I was like, okay, we are just, this is what we're doing. So I thought it'd be easier to, once we moved here, to just not have them go back to school rather than put them in school and then take them out of school. So that's kind of how we kind of use that to be our starting point, if you will. So it's been,
Yeah. So, wow, you guys have had quite a journey into unschooling.
Yeah.
How would you describe how unschooling supports each one of your needs? You've explained something, like, you've opened up the conversation wide on neurodiversity, because unschooling and neurodiversity are kind of, I mean, everyone's talking about it and everyone's talking about how it can accommodate and what we can do. And I think that more folks want to hear personal experiences in how unschooling supports those, like, individual and unique experiences.
Once I started learning about it and digging into it and kind of understanding the tenets of unschooling, I was super, super married to that. And, you know, my husband and I, we would go back and forth around, like, I was really, like, pushing, like, you know, going right into this thing and just, like, abandoning everything that we learned, you know, in the traditional system. But what I found was that was too much too soon for them to, like, transition, because we had already the transition of moving states and leaving friends and leaving that life. Then there's the transition of leaving school, and having to, like, make a lot more effort to find friends and do that. So there was just so many changes at once, and that's already hard typically for neurodivergent kids. I'm just going to say ND, moving forward, but it's already difficult. But for me, I have ADHD, and the way that my brain works, I typically, like, am in it or out of it. And I want to, like, once I, like, get my teeth into something and I'm, like, super passionate and super, like, hyper-focused on it, I'm ready to go. So a lot of our first year was really de-schooling, really. And then the pandemic hit, like, before that year was even up. So that shifted everything again. So because there were so many shifts, we really just had to make time to let everyone settle in. And the cool thing about it is, I think the thing I'm most grateful for is the time. We don't have to feel like, okay, they would be in the fourth grade right now, and, you know, we have to make sure we're getting these things. And, like, that is such a little concern of mine. The academic side was the easiest side for me to let go of first. Like, I don't want to say I don't care about it, but it's so, like, minute to me compared to their overall, like, well-being and their, like, social, emotional health and mental health. Like, that the academic things just come with that, in my opinion. You know, like they're always doing things. So of course they're going to be picking up all the skills and learning the sort the core, you know, subjects and things like that along the way. So for us, one of our challenges is that because we have sensory needs, all five of us, we're always sort of trying to figure out how to make it work being home or being in the same space with my husband working from home. The kids are really loud, but then they can't tolerate a lot of noise. So it's like this kind of tweaking all day of like how to keep them from sort of triggering each other throughout the day. But the other thing that's great is that, you know, we create space in the home so that they can do that. We make sure that, like, we prioritize, you know, headphones and whatever sort of things they need to help them, you know, basically cope, so that they can do the things that they're interested in doing. So that's kind of how we treat it. So we don't have, like, you know, they have access to iPads and TVs and video games and all those things. We don't have like limitations around that kind of stuff. And it kind of, it's really given my oldest son the room to just rest. He had a lot of, I think he had a lot of damage from the public school life because he's intellectually really, he just enjoys that side of learning. And, you know, he did school well, if you will. So there was always this pressure and perfectionism and anxiety around performing and, you know, just being the top person in the class and constantly like being moved to other classrooms to be with other students who were learning more advanced work. But then that took such a toll on him. And I think having these last couple of years to just rest and like hang out online with his friends and game and like get to like, you know, geek out over like, you know, anime and the voice actors and how they, you know, studying the crossover of the different like movies and shows that those actors appear in and like trying to like identify voices. And that just is so fun for him. Just, it's like he gets to, I think he kind of gets to be a kid more now, even though he's older than he did when he was younger, you know? While also being able to have more autonomy and enjoy his maturity, right? And have like, you know, the choice to stay home if we're all going, you know, on a meetup or something, or being able to like do something with a friend and not have mom and dad involved, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. I think it's nice to be able to see him sort of breathe a little bit. And I knew that was going to take him the most time out of all of them. You know, obviously he's been in it longer. He's also sort of a rigid thinker. So he was really attached to that, you know, do well in school, go to college, get a good job, because that's kind of what we drilled in the beginning, you know, before we knew that there was another way, you know? So we had to let it go and he had to let it go. And I had to also accept that just because I finally got it, that it doesn't mean that he, you know, doesn't still internalize that, you know. And then for my other two, they are so funny because, of course, like regular siblings, you know, everyday people, they are fighting every day, every minute of every day, and also completely inseparable. Like they're 17 months apart. And when at the time they had never gone to the same school at the same time because they were in special education programs, they weren't going to their home school. So they had to go to the school that housed the right program for them. So my kids have always been at different schools and that was just kind of part of our life. And so now they're together. And even sometimes I'm like, do you want to like take an art class like to my daughter, you know, because she's interested in that. But then she's like, no, because my brother's not coming. And I'm like, it's okay. Like, you know, it's just an hour. But I also get like that comfort and safety that they have with each other. And I know that they want to have, you know, tons of other kids and lots of friends to play with. But I think that anchoring that they're developing with each other, I think that's like, I don't know if they would have had the time and the space to do that You know what I mean? If they were in the hustle and bustle of school all the time, because it was such a hustle for them. For, my middle son is, he's also a gamer, super into gaming, into his stuff. And he comes downstairs and he's like, "Mom, I was grinding on this thing and I was hard," you know? And he's like, I'm trying to get this particular whatever and it costs this much and I'm working at this pizza place and then I'm doing deliveries and then I also, like, he built a McDonald's restaurant in one of his games and he debuted it to the family and we, you know, watched him, like, just show all this detail around, like, this restaurant and his business plan, his sort of soft business plan that he had. Which it was really fun for my husband to, like, engage, because of course, you know, he's like all about that. Like that just is like his bread and butter too. So it's kind of fun to even watch, not necessarily me connecting with it, but just even seeing how they all connect with each other in different.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was just agreeing. Yeah. I think it's really great when you can see that thing happening outside of you. Like, it's great when it's happening with just you and you're maybe the parent who is doing a lot of the conversations and a lot of the one-on-one, and the other parent is maybe working, even when they're working from home, you know, spending a lot more time working keeps them from being able to engage, you know, at as high of a level. And so when you get to step back and watch that happen with the other parent or another family member, it is really, it's something else to see.
It is. It really is. Like, it makes my day and it makes their, and it's funny because it could be like 10 minutes of that, you know, and it just kind of turns the whole day around, which I love. And my youngest, she's super creative. And I mean, even when I remember when she was in kindergarten, right around this time in the fall, she started apparently taking orders for Halloween costumes. And she was like telling people what they were going to be for Halloween. She was taking orders, but she was telling them what they were going to be. She has a very leadership type personality. We're going to call it that. And so, like, you know, she's up in the middle of the night. Like, we put her to bed. She's sleeping. And then I get up in the middle of the night and her room light is on and she's literally up, like, trying to, like, fashion together her costumes and or clothes and some mixed with doll clothes and all this stuff, like whatever she can find in her room. She's like using tape to try to put these things together because she's like, and you can tell she's in it. Like, and she, it's like she even has a deadline in her mind. Like, you could see how she was sort of like working, tracking against something. You know what I mean? It was just so interesting. But of course that made it hard during the day at school because she's exhausted now, right? And along with all the other needs that she had. But I was like, man, I cannot wait until we leave school so she can have time to do this, you know? Like, I told her the other day, I was like, I don't know if you even have time, if you really have time to go to school. Like, there's so many things that you want to touch on, you know?
Yeah.
And she's super talkative and inquisitive. I mean, she will why you down, like, but why, all the way down to the nub, like, until she has full understanding and it's in agreement, you know?
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't know for sure, especially in a general education setting where the classrooms are really, you know, they're 25 kids with one teacher and they're moving through the curriculum, that just was not going to work for her. Like, she has to raise her hand or interrupt or ask, you know, or divert. Like, her mind is going in 100 different directions and she needs to, like, address all of that. It all has the same level of priority for her, you know?
Yeah.
But
that cannot be accommodated in the classroom with, you know, 20 to 30 kids.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, just inherently, not necessarily even because there's some nefarious reason, although, you know, just my overall opinion of school is I don't love that system. But yeah, it just can't, you know, and even me, my capacity for input is low because of my own sensory needs and things like that. And so that's something I'm always working on too. Like, how do I get enough breaks, get enough quiet time, downtime, so that I can endure these conversations, you know, because I want to make sure I'm available for that. Because I know that they can go, and there's so, to me, there's so much learning and talking and listening and going forth. And it's kind of wild to me how, you know, we always hear it in the homeschooling world and the unschooling world, how people, you know, ask us about, what about socialization? And socialization really is meaning that they're teaching these people how to socialize under the sort of rules of society. It doesn't mean that they're being social. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's not really what socialization means, but they cannot be social at school. Like I used to volunteer in their classrooms, and they would have silent lunches. They would withhold recess if they didn't finish their work. Mm-hmm. You know, like they can't talk in the hallway. You know, it's like, when are they talking?
Yes, so much yes to all of that. I remember, like, single file, hands behind their back, you know, bubbles in their mouths, literally telling them to, like, hold the air in and show me visibly that you are, like, withholding anything coming out of your mouth.
Oh,
it's just, it's incredibly oppressive.
Yes.
And it just does not allow you mm-mm. to be a whole person.
Yes.
And I can imagine at a very young age for ND kids, they're having to navigate coping on not being treated like a whole person.
Exactly. And that is just, it was heartbreaking and it was frustrating, you know, and you, there's trying to talk about reform in that setting. It just is kind of futile because it's just not set up to allow for any of that. You know what I mean? Yeah. We tried to do what we could, obviously. And another reason why I was like, we should just homeschool and unschool anyway, is because I was always at their schools. I was always in IEP meetings. I was always in their classrooms or volunteering for something, because I was always like wanting to support the people who supported my kids. I know the work that it takes to do that. I know the bandwidth that it requires. And I was usually really close with the teachers. Like, we would usually just be friends outside of the class once they left their class. And they sort of became family to our family. They supported them outside of the classroom and everything. And it was great. And even with that, it was still hard for them. Like, these people were going above and beyond. Like, they truly loved what they did, and they truly cared about the kids. And, you know, but the practices just inherently were abusive. Like, I mean, I don't, but it is, you know?
I really want to have more conversations around that, going forward, around mm-hmm. what it means to abolish schools. Because I know that a lot of folks are talking about abolishing schools, and a lot of folks, but I want to talk about tangible ways that with more humane practices like self-directed education.
Yeah.
And I want to see, like, how can we implement that? What kind of dreams can we come up with? So those conversations are going to be coming.
Absolutely. You know,
because there's critical mass of mm-hmm. children that need somewhere to go during the day.
Yes.
And we can't continue to pretend that the school system is supporting anything but a small few.
Absolutely. And, you know, and even that, looking at that, like, you know, defining success and what a support. I did well in school. You know, I was the A student. You know, there was a marking period where I was the only student in the school who got straight A's every marking period that year. And they made an award just for that year. Like, but now that I'm an adult, I realize how much damage was caused by that, you know, for me, and how much the perfectionism was exacerbated, and just, it just is so much undoing that I have to do now, even in the unschooling setting, where I'm like, I want to do unschooling right. I want to do unschooling perfectly. We have to be the best unschoolers. Like, I have to get rid of that, because that's where we get attached to the unschooling and not to the kids, you know, and not to the family. But for sure, you know, I'm sure all of us who are in this sort of life are listening to other podcasts and trying to have these conversations. And there are certainly talks of unschooling the schools, and using, reallocating the resources that we already have, right? We have the buildings, we have the infrastructure, we have adults there. We just have to have them serve different purposes and live in different roles, right? As facilities, right, as support people, you know, having art class, all the different things that they offer. I mean, the schools that we used to go to, they had all kinds of classes after school, like pretty much anything you can come up with. But those were communities that were well-funded, right? Yeah. And that's a very privileged place to be in. And even being able to unschool the way we do in our family is very privileged. And it certainly needs to be a widespread offer. It should just be available to everyone. It just should.
Right. Right? And the public school needs to be a public service, right?
Right.
Travel industry.
Absolutely.
So as long as it's a private industry interested in shifting towards something that is going to make it a profit. But if we are going to truly be a public service to raise the youth of this country anyway, then we should be shifting towards something that fits better, something that is more humane. And it would be silly for us to not be having those conversations like in bigger spheres. And I'm hoping that those conversations, you know, you mentioned something like, when I really get my teeth into something, I really want to dive deep. It made me think of, I'm not sure if you saw the post on Instagram from Lucy Aiken Reed. She does the podcast Life Without School. Or it's a YouTube podcast, but I'm not sure if she actually has a podcast.
Right.
And she shared this notion of rejecting the idea of needing balance in your life and having, you know, everything always being balanced, and that humans are meant to be deeply seasonal. And, you know, there should be times in your life when you are diving deep into things, and then times when you are doing other things. And this notion of needing balance and not being able to dive deep is kind of what keeps us like behind. We're not able to break free of that, because we're constantly telling ourselves we need to find balance and do so much of so many things in order to like exist, I guess.
Yeah.
to be valid.
Yeah, to do life properly.
To be a person. Yeah. and so I love that you spoke to that, the ability that this gives all of you to just dive really deep into stuff and not just play in the shallow end of something.
I agree. And also, if they just want to touch and go something, and yeah, not treating that as some sort of failure or look at it as quitting, like reframing how we think about quitting, you know, as opposed to sampling or treating life like this sort of smorgasbord that they get to, you know, taste and explore and decide if they want to go back to it later or not, or what, like all of that is fine. You know what I mean? I think, and it leaves room for them to think about what commitment means to them, how they feel about things, how things are sitting with them when they're into something, and not as, and they're not clouded with all this external pressure around, well, we paid for this, and you know, you said you were going to do this. And not that I don't want to have elements of personal accountability there, of course. But I think that's easier to come by when you have the room to develop personal accountability. You know what I mean? Like for yourself. I think because when I hear them talking about the things that they're doing, and I don't even, you know that they're working on something for a week, you know, like on that level, you know, where they're going to sleep thinking about it and all this, you know what I'm saying? Like, I know they're doing it, but I don't know how deep it runs for them until they come back and they're like, okay, this is what I was doing. This is, you know, and I think that's so cool. But I also like that they can be like, nah, that wasn't for me. I thought I would.
Absolutely.
And so
think about how many kids are committed to, especially ones that are in school, who are committed to specific extracurriculars, and how like limited of a range those extracurriculars are.
And even within it, like it has to be done in this adult led way, you know, it's not completed until you've reached this mark in it. So even within the pursuit of something, the overstructuring of it, it just kind of kills the ability for them. We, just like the conversation you and I just had about thinking bigger, about having schools available to everyone that are self-directed, right? And mm-hmm. we have to reimagine that. Like, we're kind of thinking within the confines of the system that we already have. If we're raising people who are going to be taking the reins on this stuff, like, they need to be able to think beyond what an instructor is telling them, you know, or what somebody calls, you know, music or art or engineering or what. Like, there's just has to be an expansion of that. And the mind is there, you know, the mm-hmm. as humans, we have all of that. It's just the system is not, it's just really suffocating that, you know. We don't have to teach our children how to learn, or we don't have to make them curious, you know. We just have to move away from blocking them,
right?
You know, so I love that they can just get to be. And I think even for my own kids, they don't realize how much freedom they have to be themselves sometimes, because they miss school, because they miss their life that they had before, and they associate that with school. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But then I'm like, okay, let's simulate a day where you would be going back to school, right? Like, let's be up at 7 and dressed and ready to go and packed your lunch and had your breakfast. And, you know, there's no iPad before you, like, we have to get, you know, we have to go. The bus is coming. You know, you're in your classroom. You have to be quiet. You know, you remember this stuff. It's like, they see the droves of children coming home, and they see them on their bikes, and they see kids getting off the bus. And it looks so fun because, of course, like, a group of kids looks fun. But then when you think about the 8 hours that they had before that, and not to say that just every day of school is absolute, you know, terror for these kids, but what it was like for my kids compared to what they have now, I think sometimes they have a hard time connecting those dots a little bit, you know what I mean? Because of how, and that's why I have to really ask the questions and not just jump to like, oh, I'm not doing this right, or there's something wrong here, as opposed to just being curious and saying, what actually are you missing? What are you looking to have? What do you want? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that one, of course, helps them feel heard rather than just being dismissed. And even trying to hurry up and fix it can make them feel dismissed. Like, if I just said, okay, I'm just going to put you in school then, that actually can make them feel like they're not being listened to. You know what I mean? Right. Even though they're getting what they asked for, if you will.
Right.
You know?
Well, sometimes children are asking for something because they don't have any other language or a way to really conceptualize what mm-hmm. they want. And mm-hmm. so they're accessing the closest thing that it is to that they can say. So,
Absolutely. Which is why, again, conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and between peers, like, I love when they're talking, the stuff that they get from talking with friends, or even, you know, chatting with their cousins who live in other states and everything, is just, it's just cool. The stuff that I'm like, you guys are really maturing. Like, the way that you guys resolve that, that's like, I might need to take that on a little bit, you know, like, it's cool.
There is so much to the conversation around school, and to expand on that in future conversations. Mm-hmm. We can shift to more independent needs of ND mm-hmm. kids at home, and maybe circle back around to screens. I don't talk a lot about screens here, and it's because I generally disagree with, you know, getting in the way or in between screens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just not a topic that I ever really cover. It's oftentimes something that people ask, and if there's ever time, I will. But this particular conversation is something that I shared on Instagram that I was going to be having a conversation more specific to unschooling. I said, what do people want to hear about? I had an overwhelming response of neurodiverse kids and screens. What do we do? I'm like, and I had a wide range of people just feeling like they have no tools, and that unschooling tells them to give unlimited access, and they're struggling with it at home because of all kinds of responses that are, you know, maybe heavily emotional responses that mom or dad or grandpa or grandma or whoever's at home are having a difficult time with. Some even including because they really want their games. So this is that I wanted to bring to you and say, what do you think? What kind of tools are there for some of these parents?
So, you know, for us, and I always just have to preface and say that we're 100% still in the we're figuring it out too phase life, you know, like we're constantly tweaking. First, we don't even use the word screens because that's so generalized and it doesn't really express what we're really talking about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they have TVs in their rooms and, you know, around the house, and they're all available to them and they're on or not. Our thing is more like, are you watching it? And let's turn it off if you're not, because like, right, resources and bills and mm-hmm. managing the things that we have and being mindful. And the other thing, there are days when they just like want to watch shows all day or movies all day or even YouTube all day. And that's not a problem for me. Or if they're on their iPads, or sometimes they're on, one kid is watching the TV and the other kids in the living room, you know, also on their iPad, you know, mm-hmm. where we have challenges is when they're eating and, or they need to do something self-care, like if, you know, if they need to get their showers done or whatever, and they're still held up doing whatever they're doing on their iPad. So for me, I know there's like lots of conversation around the addictive properties of games that are on these things, or even watching like YouTube videos or whatever. And I can't necessarily say that I disagree with that. However, especially for kids like ours, and for myself included, my phone is not like a screen. Like, my phone is where I access everything. It's where I read all my stuff. It's where I journal. It's where I talk to people. It's where, you know what I'm saying? So it's mm-hmm. not the screen, right? It's like I fidget with word puzzles. Like, I have to do that while I watch TV. And sometimes my husband would get frustrated because he's like, are you paying attention? And I'm like, yes, I actually can't process what's happening in the show unless I'm like doing this puzzle at the same time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so when I think about what they're doing, I always go back to myself and I would say, okay, what would I say? Like, what do I do? What do I notice that I do? Because it's not uncommon for the parents and the child to have similar profiles around like how their wiring is. And so I kind of use that as a reference point when I'm starting to get frustrated and I say, okay, what are they getting? What are they trying to achieve? Are they in the middle of something? Are they working on something and they're trying to finish it out? You know, for us, I've started using sort of like primary activity and supportive activity. And that's kind of how I've been phrasing it for them. So like, if we need to eat dinner, and like we have Milkshake Friday in our house. And so every Friday, I think since for like 6 years, like a thing now, we go and get milkshakes after dinner. But that means that you need to like finish dinner by a certain time, because if you want it from this place, they close at this time or whatever, you know, just the logistical things. So we kind of work backwards from that and say, okay, these are going to be your choices available if we don't finish by this time. Okay, so if you're gaming on your iPad versus watching something, is it easier for you to eat while you're watching something versus when you're actively, you know, swiping your iPad and interacting with it? Like, pay attention to the time it takes you to eat, because that's going to limit what your options are. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I'm like, okay, the thing that we have to get done is this thing. This has to get done. I have no problem with however you need to support that activity. However, if the supporting activity is interfering with the primary activity, then we need to remove or reduce the supporting activity. And just in this moment, it's not like a new rule. Mm-hmm. It's like right now. But it makes them have to pay attention to like, oh, am I getting lost in my game again? And I'm not eating. My food is getting cold. And then I don't like it cold. And now it's a sensory issue. Do you know? It's like things just kind of unravel from there. So these are like, I just try to use logic, right? And like, say, I notice, because I don't really, outside of like, you know, there are times when of course it inconveniences me or holds me up from doing something. And that has to count too, right? Like, mom's tired and, right, you know, or I have somewhere that I have to be. So, you know, I have to be on time for this, which means you just may have to get shakes tomorrow, right? Or something. So for us, it's kind of like, I don't have, I'm neutral about screens, as if screens, however, you know, it's more about like, if, cause if it were a book and they were deep diving in their book and they weren't eating, it would be the same conversation. You know what I mean? It's more about like, how is it supporting them? For my oldest son, he was like, I have to have my iPad at the table for me to eat. I have to be watching something and I have to have my headphones on because the sound of other people chewing and the back and forth with the little ones, like, it's too much. So, okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. And it doesn't impede his ability to eat and do things. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, is this supporting you, or is this, you know, hurting what you're trying to get done, the overall goal? And sometimes it is something that is imposed on them, if you will, around like, this has to get done. This is a sort of boundary that we have in our home. Like, you do need to eat. Yeah. If you don't eat, right. Like, you get hangry, you, right. Then you start, you go into a meltdown place because your body is like, I cannot handle this anymore. Then when you start melting down and you're screaming, that piercing sound is now, you're making your sister feel oversensitized, and now she's screaming, right? And now, so that's something that we just can't have going on all the time, right? Like, it's just too stressful for everybody. So we have to take care of our basic needs. You have to do that, so that you can do the things that you want to do. So that's kind of how we frame it as far as like gaming. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah, I think that's an interesting perspective to frame it as, instead of looking for a way to take it away, to transition them to other things, right, looking for a way to allow them to use it as a supporting thing, as long as it's not impeding on the thing being done. And I think that could be really monumental for a lot of parents. I've spoken to so many parents who have said in private to me something to the effect of, I can do everything except this screen thing. Like, my child is like melting down and screaming and hitting me and, you know, hurting siblings and all of these things going on. And I just can't get on board. And I've never made a statement that said everyone should be, you know, as open to digital media as I am. But I also think that maybe the issue was just unidentified to me, that it was that they were trying to remove it rather than learning for, like, looking for a way to say yes.
Yes, that's really what it is, right? Like, if they trust that we're trying to support what they're looking for or what their needs are, and because it's a need for them in a lot of cases, you know what I mean? It's like, like assistive technology. That's kind of how I view it. Even when they were in their classrooms, they were using tech to assist, you know. It just, I find for me, like, sometimes when I've been over talking and I just kind of go into a sort of selective mutism space, and even that term is kind of a misnomer because it's not selective, but if I've kind of spent myself and I can't really use a lot of words, I will just make an announcement on Alexa, and then that's all the conversation I can have. You know what I mean? Like, I can't do a lot of back and forth or whatever. So there's no, we don't have this like judgment around using technology. I think we should be like trying to minimize. I would rather let something that's tech take care of something that I can allocate to that, so I can save up my spoons for things that, where I really need to be engaged with them and really need to be, you know, present. That's kind of how I think about it for me, for my husband, same thing. And, you know, same thing for them. Now, when it comes to like gaming or any of that, I don't know. We just never had an issue with that. My husband is a gamer himself. He's been a gamer like since we were dating, since before then. So that's always been a part of our lives. Like, we game as a family, you know. So it's not, I think the other thing is, it's not this thing that's separate from us, as in the kids versus the parents. This is the kids' thing and not our thing. And I think when the kids feel that, it makes it something that they want to hold on to even more. Of course, they're going to feel like they have to defend it. And it's, you know, you just don't understand, mom. But there's not really many times when we have to transition them away from it, like on a regular basis like that. But when we do, they get a heads up. Like it's kind of like any other transitions that we have to work through in our house. Like right. That's just, I don't transition well. I can sit in my car for an hour when I pull in my driveway, just because I cannot transition spaces. I have to like get on my phone and decompress from whatever I was doing and then go inside, you know, and that's yeah. just, you know, and I noticed that more and more when I started paying attention to my kids, and then I learned about myself sort of retroactively. And I was like, okay, so then it's no different for them, right? Like, okay.
Yes, I'm smiling so big because you have no idea how many people are probably going to be like, thank you for saying this out loud.
Oh, yeah.
You are saying things that people also are experiencing, and it doesn't get said out loud. And I think that it's going to make several people that I know of that are definitely going to be listening out for this episode, is going to make them feel so seen to know that they do those same types of things and have a difficult time transitioning and are learning themselves as they're learning about their children's neurodiversities. Mm-hmm. And it's just really, really great for you to speak to that for so many people.
Absolutely. Like, it's just kind of an understanding in our house. Like, this is just how we are, you know what I mean? This is how we live. I think people feel nervous about saying anything negative at all about, you know, living the unschooling life and approaching the world this way, because it's already hard enough to kind of get people to understand it. We're already, you know, a kind of fringe group, if you will. You know, so it's like, you never really want to publicly say, well, this is hard though. This part is hard. But I think the other part of that is, because life and learning aren't separate, this is not like an educational model for us. I mean, I'm grateful that it was listed that way, because that's how I learned about it. That's how I came across it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also misleading, because the education piece is so small compared to the rest of it. You know, like that part is how people think of it, because the word unschooling is in there. But when we really think about what schooling means, it's really just about, you know, the conformity, right? Getting everyone kind of do the same thing the same way, and we all look alike and all that. So that's what we're undoing. We're really like deprogramming, you know, the deschooling for our family is probably the biggest part. We're still for sure deschooling. I'm deschooling even today. I was like, oh my gosh, I have to let that go again. Because I was even thinking about when they're having upsets, I realize it's hard for me to listen to when they're upset about something, because I feel personally responsible for it. And so my guilt just becomes this like unbearable cloud. And then it's hard for me to just allow them to kind of work through that emotion and work through that process and come out on the other side, because I'm always trying to jump in and remedy it so that I can sort of assuage my own guilt. Mm. And just being okay with, like, if they have a meltdown, it doesn't mean that I'm not parenting them well or being a good mom to them. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's, and that's hard as a parent, with kids like ours, because there are a lot of things that can make them feel that way. Their environment is full of things that can overwhelm them. That's just what it is. And it really creates a lot of hypervigilance in us as parents, because we're like constantly surveilling the environment. What is, you know, is it too cold outside? Is it partially humid? And, you know, like, is the truck going by too loud? Like, all these things can kind of like turn your day upside down sometimes, you know?
Right.
And so, of course, we're constantly looking for ways to not exacerbate those things. And, you know, but I think, like I said earlier, the fact that we have time, the fact that we have space and room to focus on how to make our day flow better, just what is working for us right now. Because when I notice I get really anxious when I get too big and I try to like have this macro view of everything, like, okay, if we get up at this time and, you know, we eliminate this and we add that in and we do this and we journal about that, you know, then we'll have an outcome, you know what I'm saying? And it's like, and then I'm starting to talk to my husband and I'm kind of getting worked up, and he's like, okay, just, you don't have to know all the answers and solve everything and find another specialist and go and, you know, yell at the whole mental health community for being in the research. Like, Because it's such a thing for me. It's really hard, because when we do look for support, like occupational therapy, or speech and language therapy for some of our kids, it's like the support is sometimes making things worse and or just not helpful. And the work that it takes to even get the support, get access to that, you know, financially, or even if you're an ND person and making phone calls is hard, or having executive functioning to like organize your schedule and get into those appointments and be on a waiting list. And it, all of that stuff is really taxing. And then if you finally get in with somebody, you know, after they charge you $1,800 for the session, just to either completely dismiss you and tell you there's nothing wrong or there's nothing, you know, or try to convert your kid into someone who's more neurotypical, it's just so disheartening, because you're like, where is my help? Where is my support? You know? And I think that's why I feel so strongly about getting more people just in the general population on board with how we are all different and how we can just be naturally supportive to each other. So we have a built-in village with our friends, with our family, you know, feeling like we have to do all this vetting all the time, you know? It's like,
well, and like the special of everything, like special classes and specialists that help with this and that. Yes. Like, why are we just not more accommodating all around?
Yes. Yeah.
Like, we are not accommodating the wide spectrum of people.
Period.
That exist.
As a whole, you know, and every way, right? Like,
right.
Not even going into like, you know, being Black and being neurodivergent and
right.
Like, we're all, it's like we kind of whittle down our community so much, because trying to find people who kind of get us, if you will, it's like it gets hairy sometimes, you know, and then not to mention the medical community and the support community and that kind of thing, where you're trying to get your kids someone to be able to talk to and vent to and have a safe space for them. But if they don't understand the language of neurodiverse people, then they misinterpret that as, you know, their approach to it actually sometimes worsens it. We've had that with my oldest, where he actually would come out of sessions and it would put him into such an extreme state of just distress. He couldn't even go back to school afterwards. He was literally just melting, because it actually triggered more anxiety, created more issues, created more distrust. You know what I'm saying? So it's the work that we do on the sort of the like underground work of just setting up their support system, that's its own animal. Let alone like, you know, trying to make sure that just the people in your immediate circle get your kids and can just, you know, but yeah, so anything that I don't have to take away, I don't, you know.
Right. I love that. I love the idea of finding a way to still be supportive with the yes. And I've struggled with how to talk about the use of digital media for that very reason, because I don't want to seem insensitive to the fact that some people have struggles around that. But I definitely want to encourage people to dig down at the root of why they're uncomfortable with that, as opposed to a kid, you know, sketching in a sketchbook all day, or, you know, beating all day, or whatever else, you know, they're doing, skateboarding all day.
Yep.
There's so many other activities that children could take really deep dives into and become quote unquote obsessed with that many people wouldn't bat an eye at.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that we should look at digital media and all of the things that come with screens and devices as the same kinds of tools and advancements that early man once found in rocks and sticks. So
exactly.
It's really no different.
I that's how I've always felt about it. We just never had, like, I guess that made it easier, right? Like, we didn't have to do that shift. There are other shifts that we still have to make around like food and things like that, and how if that's affecting them and that kind of stuff. So I get why people feel that way about screens. I really do. I think what helped me though is really just going back to not even using that term screens. I think that's actually doing a disservice to the screens, if you will, because it's not allowing the parent to really see like what is the engagement, where is the engagement at, what's pulling your kid in and what's feeding them, you know what I mean? And I also think even the obsessive thing is scary for parents, because outside of like literacy, like if they're like reading a book, we sort of laud that, like it's like, okay, that has like high value in society,
right? But
if they are like, you know, skateboarding all day, then it's like, okay, well, are they learning to write, are they learning to do these things, you know? Sometimes even that is scary for people, because if it's sort of this unilateral thing, then are they getting enough other experiences, are they being well-rounded, or am I, you know, if they're just hyper focused on this one thing. But I again, that goes back to people can be deeply seasonal, like you said, mm-hmm. right? Like there's room to do that. We don't have to, school makes us think we have to be touching all these different things at one time.
Right.
You don't get to build a relationship with those things the way you might want to when you do that, you know? Right. You can have it available to them, keep them, you know, keep the options open. We're not saying shut everything off. We're saying allow them to choose.
Yeah.
And then let them interact with it, as long as you're not seeing like things where, you know, they're creating harm and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I know that gets really sticky. But I would say, don't just make an overarching sweeping thing of like, okay, no screens, like maybe go back to figuring out how to say yes and right. how that can work. Yeah.
Right.
But I think for the kids, I kind of go by, did they go through their day where they're coming to the end of the day and they just didn't feel like it was just this unbearable experience? You know what I mean? It's not going to be that every day ends on this, you know, Mary Poppins, you know, cherry on top kind of feeling. But overall, are we seeing that they're enjoying their lives? You know what I'm saying? And I don't necessarily think that having a meltdown in the day means that they're not enjoying their lives, because that's really hard for us. You know, like it doesn't mean, I also don't want to have this pressure on your kid to be happy. I think that's performative too. Like, you have to be happy for me so I can be okay. You know what I mean? Like make sure I'm okay as a parent. But just, do they feel like their cups were filled? Do they feel like, you know, they got time in with me where they didn't have to keep, because I will tell you, when I'm trying to, when they're wanting me to like watch them play Roblox, I'm like, bruh, or if they want me to play Minecraft with them, you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, okay, listen, mommy's attention span works like this. And it's hard because it makes me feel guilty again, because I don't want them to read that as, you know, they're not, that my relationship to them means a lot, right? So like my inability to focus, it is interpreted differently in that relationship, you know? So if I tend to pick up my phone while they're like doing their, you know, fifth building in Minecraft or whatever, like I have to constantly bring my own self back, you know, so that they can get what they need, but also communicate like, these are mommy's limitations too. Like I have to make sure that, because I don't want to be doing it when I'm cranky and angry and making it miserable. And that's not fun. Right. You know, like they don't want to feel like you didn't want to be there, you know?
Right.
But so for the better, I say like, that's how I look at it for me. Like, how can I do this so that, because most of my ultimate goal, I want to show up for my kids. I want to give them this life where they have a chance to get to know who they are, how they tick, you know, that's going to give them the tools to like live in the world. And hopefully by the time they are in the world, you know, without me more, that the world is in a place where it's easier for them to navigate and it's more accepting and all that. But in the meantime, like, even while we're here, are they finding their ways to deal, you know, on their own? Are they feeling empowered to like, okay, I know, you know, the dogs bark right around the time that they're about to get fed, because they just do. And so I need to have my headphones ready, that kind of thing, you know, where they're like taking more power over like managing their needs, as opposed to, which, you know, I'm not saying I expect them to just master it all today or anything, but just I can kind of see and notice that they've sort of seen the pattern and picked up the trend and said, okay, this makes this easier for me. I know what I want and I know what I need to do to get it so that it's not so hard for me. That's kind of how I gauge their self-improvement, really.
Right.
You know, right. Of course, you know, especially when they're pursuing their things and they're having the success in those things and having the outcomes that they expect, or if they don't get the outcomes they expect and they manage that well, that's great. You know, if they manage the disappointment and they can take it like, you know, that sucked, or I'm going to cry, but then I'm also going to be like, okay, I got it. And I learned that. That's great to witness as a parent, you know, that's them to be able to be whole and all that. But I also know that their road to get there may not look like other kids. And that's, right. I think that's where I try to be mindful of the ableism, even, or even the internalized ableism that I'm now projecting onto them, you know?
Yeah.
So like if they have to do like, you know, they put their, when they go take a shower, they bring their iPads and they hook it all up in a way that they can still like get their music and do their stuff or whatever. Mm-hmm. And has to have like something in his ears so he can unload the dishwasher, because I have to do the same thing to clean anything. I have to have a pocket. Mm-hmm. I have to, you know, or even like for people who have ADHD, a lot of times we require what's called body doubles. So that like if we're doing a task that's highly unpreferred or requires a lot of like mental energy and it doesn't have like a lot of reward at the end, we'll kind of need someone to either help us get started on it or just be in the same space with us while we're doing the task. They don't have to do it with us. Like if my husband's sitting at the counter while I'm washing dishes, I can breeze through it. It's nothing. But if it's like, I'm trying to hurry up, you know, and do stuff with the kids and wash the dishes and cook dinner, it's like much, you know?
And what happens when that occurs? Do you just freeze?
What ends up happening is I'll spend all day trying to do that one thing and I don't get to the other things that I want to do. Yeah. Then at the end, I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't, you know, I feel like I failed the day. I wanted to be able to show up in this way. And then that ended up taking all my energy. And then I still feel like I didn't do it because housework is something that never ends. Right.
Right.
And so like having to reframe that for myself. So this is like, or I have to constantly get on like different random hacks and YouTube things or other like TikTokers who share my sort of wiring. And we like, they have like little tricks and tips and we just kind of like do it together, if you will, like virtual body doubles. And so I realized that my kids need those same, would not necessarily the exact same tools, but they would need their own hacks to do certain things. And so the more we move away from judging how they achieve the thing and or if that thing has to be achieved necessarily, if that's really necessary, I think that's how I kind of make sure that I'm not imposing this societal, you know, expectation that's not reasonable on them, you know.
All of this has me thinking about like the idea of self-improvement for ND kids in school, and how you're talking about all of this that you're noticing even for yourself around just, you know, trying to get a task like washing the dishes done for the day. Mm-hmm. And if you are in school and you're not being supported in a way that allows you the time, right, to do all of those things and to come to those conclusions, that that system already in and of itself is ableist. But then the folks that are working within the programs that are for those ND kids, I'm sure don't think or see themselves as ableists most of the time. And probably most of them are good people. But there's almost sort of this infantilizing that happens in school. Yeah. And a lot of folks have shared that with me that it's like, there's no path to adulthood. There's no path to, I'm not saying success or, you know, a certain amount of productivity, but there's no path to adulthood if this school is going to infantilize them in this way. It's really humiliating.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
It's like this weird thing of, like you said, infantilizing them and being really, deciding that they're just incapable of everything, right, versus like completely dismissing what their needs are so that they can have success in whatever view of success it is for that particular thing. It's like this weird, like one or the other, you know, either I completely dismiss the fact that you are capable, like you have your own opinion still, you have your own autonomy, you still have feelings and needs and wants, you know, just like everybody else in the room. Even if you don't communicate them in the same way, which is also really misunderstood. Like if, you know, if they're non-speaking, they're thinking right. that means they're not feeling or they're not, you know what I mean? Like that's, so yeah, it is, it just, again, it's sort of baked in, right? Like where yes. there's just not really any room for them to, one, understand it because that's not what they're taught either. Like the programs are still teaching these things, right? Like when right. people go through these master's programs to be special ed teachers and so forth, you know, I read an account of someone who is neurodivergent and wanted to go into special ed because they wanted to sort of be able to not have to perpetuate what they experienced in the program. They're just basically teaching all the same things. And this person is objecting to these things saying, this is damaging. This is hurtful to us, you know? They're just constantly being dismissed, you know, and no different than even, you know, I'm sure the medical community, what they're continuing to be taught. So of course, why it's like this thing of not listening to actually autistic people or actually disabled people or whatever that group is, you know?
Right.
So if you're an adult person who's advocating for your child in that system and you're saying, hey, this is their need. And the school is like, okay, but it's not tracking against what's necessary for our numbers and our funding and so forth and so on. Then you're just, that's just not going to be a priority.
Yeah. So, you
know. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
I was just going to say, maybe, do we have any ideas around ways to improve the existing systems? And honestly, I don't have answers either. I'm just at the tip of the iceberg of this, but I feel a deep responsibility working in SDE to educate myself and have been working very hard to do so. And I'm only at the tip. And I think that in order for neurodiverse folks to have to get a break from constantly explaining their needs, neurotypical people need to educate themselves on what it means to coexist with other humans who maybe aren't like them.
I agree for sure. It's kind of hard for me to not have the answers. This is where the challenge comes in and where I sort of get overwhelmed because it does feel like the same way you feel the deep responsibility, I feel that same way where I'm kind of shouldering this thing where I'm like, okay, well, this is an issue for us, but I also don't really know what the alternative is right now, you know, because I still have to have the bandwidth to make sure that I'm showing up for my actual kids, even though I want to save everybody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that of like, toggling between the society and the culture versus like what's happening at home and what you're offering them right now so that they're not slipping through the cracks, you know?
Right.
And yes, that is pretty much what I battle with all the time. I'm like, which is why I kind of was like, the reform conversation just needs to not be a conversation because that's just going to be, we're going to be swimming uphill with that. It's just better to scratch it and start a system that includes everyone. But I think for me, because I'm still learning about myself in this way and still figuring out my own coping ways and my own, you know, sort of mechanisms to achieve what I'm looking for. I think just having the conversations is pretty much where I'm at right now. And
right.
as listeners listen in and it maybe triggers a thought for them and they're like, oh, this is something I do or don't do. I know there are a lot of influencers that are and a lot of autistic adults who are having these conversations as well. And so I try to follow a lot of them for myself and for my kids. But even that, I get information overload and I have to just breathe, be like, okay, I just, you know, a little bit at a time. Cause again, it's like a hyper focus and I want to fix it now and I want it to change now. But I don't know the answer and that stresses me out. Cause I just want it to appear.
Well, this is the beginning of finding answers. We're going to start finding answers and just have this conversation spread because, in my opinion, it's not going to be an answer this specifically for ND kids. It's going to be an answer that is more humane and for everyone, like you said. Yes. So
Absolutely.
If we look at applying SDE on a wider scale and ways of implementing that, I think that we can, I think that something can happen out of that. In fact, I met someone recently who shared an idea with me that I thought was kind of interesting. I don't entirely grasp it, but the bones of the idea were simply one district in the nation starts with one school that is purely SDE. And it's a flagship school that just gives people the opportunity in that district to try it out if they want. And eventually it grows to having one SDE campus out of every district, in that state, and then just kind of outwardly makes its way, until more and more people get a taste of what that's like and see it in action when it's got enough funding to have, you know, a wood shop that's fully operational and people working on cars and people, you know, building things and computing things and all kinds of things happening, you know, think about what the things we can do at home, but in a bigger setting.
Right. And I think that's kind of where I'm like, okay, let me sort of master this little microcosm of my here, you know, so that we can kind of expand on those things. Because yeah, like, when I think about kids with sensory needs, and it's still, it, you know, even if we're talking an SDE setting, there's still a lot of people in one space. There's still a lot of stimulus and or stimuli and support and, you know, noise and conversation and
right.
a lot of movement and action in one space. And so like, what do those spaces look like, you know, so that they can actually participate in that and everybody can have a chance at it, but it's not overwhelming. You know, that typically means like more spaces, but that are smaller, more staffing, you know, more people available to do that. But of course, you know, when you think about like logistically and financially and everything, of course, it's easier to be able to do one thing with 30 people than it is to do 30 things with one person each, you know?
Yeah.
So like just trying to understand what the feasibility would be like for people who just, or even just highly sensitive people in general, introverts, all that stuff, you know, different personality types, all of those things, how that would be, how that could service them in a way that's like still functional for everyone. Yeah. Too, you know,
what I'm finding in the Sudbury world is, first of all, I'm still experimenting and learning as I'm so new to seeing it up close and being implemented up close. So I've read all about it and intellectually understand it, but to actually see it happening is very different. But I'm seeing something happen in Sudbury where everyone's needs are met by the group deciding as a consensus of how things are run.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm not sure quite yet how I feel. I'll have to report back at another time about that, but I'm not quite sure how I feel about the matter of which to get there. Sudbury uses parliamentary procedures and meetings and a school meeting capacity, and there's voting, and there's not necessarily a consensus. There is a majority that mm-hmm. can effectively overrule a minority if that particular setting chooses to execute it in that way. But generally speaking, in a Sudbury setting, you're looking at passionate of people. So they are kind of looking for a consensus. So the idea is to have conversations and debate until you get to something that everybody agrees on.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge I see with that is that perhaps maybe some ND kids might struggle with that process being really long, whereas others might like the process being long and detailed and step by step.
Right.
So how to govern a space like that, I guess, is maybe where that's coming back to. How can you Right. come up with functional rules and spaces and something that meets everybody's needs that isn't a difficult process to come to, but isn't a top-down hierarchical process where the adults are kind of over all of the kids in a way that, you know, maintaining that power over structure.
Right.
So it's a huge conversation.
It is. I was thinking that too, when I was looking at SDE options for them, you know, I was wondering, would their voices still get muted just, you know, sort of by nature, by the process, if they're not able to sustain, you know, like you said, or withstand something that's that, detailed and involved, and or if they just get voted out just because they're too small of a representative of their group, you know.
Right.
So I do wonder about that too, like what that looks like. But then I also wonder if our numbers change around what the makeup of those students are, if that would help also, because I think
that's
too, of course, like the, you know, you're literally the minority in a lot of spaces. And so a lot of times things can sort of go in that direction. So that's why I think it's, you know, doubly, triply important to make sure everyone has access to these types of things, because we need representation and in these settings for the kids so that they're used to that. Because even for my kids, I still have to be like, hey, you have your set of needs, but so do they. And then you have to be mindful of that too, you know? So that's an ongoing thing. So for sure, it's very healthy for these kids to be having these conversations and be constantly aware of what their needs look like, what others' needs around them look like. But I wonder the same thing about how we have a system that works to meet everyone's needs.
It is the belief that any self-directed alternative model right now that is operating, if they are not moving towards more consensus and more intersectional lens on the way they're doing things to include all types of people, then that work is not very restorative for communities. So I think there's probably a clear division in folks that are moving towards that kind of restorative justice and folks that are moving towards, you know, just using these procedures to uphold white supremacy, to speak frankly.
Right. For sure. And that's, you know, that's why I say unschooling is in everything. It's not just the education. The education perpetuates this system, right? It helps maintain it through the generations, but it's everything has to be addressed. We're talking everything, really. But I think kind of doing it from the ground up, you know, starting with the next group of people who's going to be taking over is critical, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, for sure, it's a process, and I have to be better about being patient that it's going to take, you know, some time to work through all things, and it's okay to just have conversations without necessarily having exact conclusions. You know, that's I think a de-schooling thing, is to say we may answer right now. You know,
that's right.
It's just a process.
It really is. It's probably going to take us a while. And I think when I pulled my oldest out of school, it was kind of in this idea that I knew I couldn't challenge that system and have enough energy to win, quote unquote, at any point in time before my child would outgrow the system. So I just opted out.
Yes. Yes. My husband says to me, he's like, you're out there fighting the world, but in the meantime, we still have to help them have tools to navigate what the world is right now while you continue to work to have the world that you would like for them, you know? Yeah. And it's true. Like we said, splitting that energy to make sure our kids have us, you know, because that's really the crux of it all, is that relationship and them walking out into the world, having that solid relationship with us and with themselves and so forth, that's going to be, you know, critical.
Yeah. This is the dance of multiplicity.
Yeah.
So many things, having to hold it all at the same time.
Absolutely.
Well, before I let you go, I have kept you on and burned up a lot of your time. I apologize if it's been too long. We could go on and probably should do it again. I'm sure I'm going to get some responses and go, why didn't you ask this? I'm sure I missed things. But do you have any resources that you want to share?
Most of my books around that I've used for unschooling are parenting books, because that's the side that I came in on. And that's probably the biggest component of it for us, and probably for most people. I read The Whole Brain Child. It's by Daniel J. Siegel and Tina Payne Bryson. Obviously, any of the works by Alfie Kohn, Punished by Rewards is one of the books, but also his other works. There's Beyond Behaviors by Mona Delahoukie, PhD. There's also, and now some of these books too, like I pull some things and I leave some things, you know, because there's still, even within the unschooling community and even within the parenting and conscious parenting community, there's still nuances there. So I just apply it to my family that, you know, in the way that I think is most fitting. Of course, Raising Free People by Akilah S. Richards. We love her. Everybody.
Bedside book. Everyone needs it.
Yes. That's staple. The Five Love Languages of Children, Unschooling Rules. But I will send you, and then of course, you know, all the Peter Gray work, all the work like Free to Learn, How Children Learn, you know, all those sort of, I feel like those are sort of your like primary books. I haven't revisited those in a while. Those are kind of early on in my
process. Those are those gateway books.
Yeah, for sure. You know, but yeah, so I definitely, and then podcasts, of course yours, of course, what is it? Unschooling, Joyfully, Living Joyfully.
Oh, Living Joyfully with Pam. Yeah.
Honey, I'm Homeschooling the Kids. All of those are just kind of like my go-to in the beginning. And I kind of took a break from any more information. I had to, so that I could actually implement something and so that I can actually like live with my kids, because I was kind of like studying them, but not living with them.
Yeah.
So it's been a while since I've read and done any of that, because I just kind of need to be in the day with them. But I'm sure I'm going to be revisiting some of that stuff, but I'll certainly send you over everything so that, whoever wants to kind of get into this space can have some other options. But yeah, I would like to have some more neurodivergent stuff, but I think I'm kind of selective about that. So take a little while.
I've had people sending me, you know, different accounts online to follow. And read.
I get it. Yeah. Most of the information is there rather than books.
Yeah. And I think it's making it a lot simpler for people to access smaller bits of information to digest, versus needing to read an entire book. And I myself am guilty of like buying lots and lots of books and feeling like I need to read so many different books. And I'm returning back to, you know, a handful of books that I feel are really groundbreaking in just changing the way that I think. And they're not all necessarily parenting books, but and just rereading those books over and over and over again.
Yes. Because,
Yeah. It helps it sink in. And it helps me get out of this idea that like I've read it, move on to the next one, like consume rather, you know, really letting it seep in, like in my bones.
That's right. Cause it's very schoolish to do that, you know, to consume and not get to like, let it be a part of you. Definitely. Memes, honestly, meme therapy has been really helpful because it's just, like you said, bite-sized and easy to access.
Yep.
And that's good for me.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Demetria. I really appreciate it. This was a great conversation. We only touched the tip of the iceberg, but...
Yeah, there's more to come, for sure.
Yeah, more to come. I appreciate you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Really, this has been great, like you said, and we for sure have a lot more work to do, but I'm glad to be contributing to, you know, the conversation for sure.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being here, for sharing in this growth and in these vulnerable conversations and expanding our understanding of partnering with children of all types. I know this episode was a long one and there are so many more things to discuss. I'm really learning a lot about ND families and how they've felt about thrusting into unschooling. And I really appreciate Demetria speaking to so many experiences that I've heard personally. Check out the show notes for all of her resources and the ways to contact me. And I won't burn up any more airtime. So until next time, stay kind to each other.